and welcome to Cato Surveillance Week 2023. I'm Patrick Eddington, Senior Fellow here at the Institute. We're so delighted that you're able to join us for this panel, the first of four that will take place this week, each day at 1 p.m. Eastern. And today we're going to be taking a look back as well as a little bit of a look at what's going on right now with respect to the legacy, essentially, of 9/11 in a domestic surveillance and maybe even an international surveillance context. Just a couple of quick administrative notes here before we actually dive in and I do the introductions of our very distinguished panel today. You can submit your questions online via our webpage, Facebook, and YouTube, as well as on Twitter. And if you're on Twitter, please use the hashtag Century of Surveillance. And I'll just say, if you simply, you know, type in Century of Surveillance into Google and put Cato with that, it will take you to the timeline that we built that basically covers the period from the very early 20th century, pretty much up to the present, a whole series of events, some of which are still underway, as you'll see, from that particular timeline. But please do use that hashtag as we go forward. I want to turn now and give a quick introduction to, you know, each of our panelists here. Pat Toomey, the Deputy Director of the ACLU's National Security Project. Faiza Patel, Senior Director of the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. And finally, Kerry Cordero, a former Assistant U.S. Attorney, as well as the Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow and General Counsel at the Center for New American Security. Thank you all so much for carving out time to be with us today. I'll just say very quickly to kind of, you know, break the ice a little bit. You know, I was actually homesick on 9/11. I was actually, ironically, supposed to be in the very section of the Pentagon that was ultimately hit by one of the airliners. And when I finally managed to roll out of bed a little bit after 9 a.m. on that morning, I turned on NBC. And of course, I saw the first tower burning, and the news anchors, including Katie Couric, you know, saying that a plane had struck one of the towers in New York City, one of the World Trade Center towers. And for the life of me, I couldn't understand how that could possibly have happened, because it was a perfectly clear sky and an absolutely beautiful morning. And then it was only about 30 minutes later that I watched in complete horror as the second aircraft was rammed in to the other tower. And it was in that instant that I knew that we were under attack. And that I also knew that it was almost certainly Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda that was responsible for it. That organization, of course, having been responsible for the attacks on our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, and then the attack on the USS Cole in Aden, Yemen in the fall of 2000. I knew as soon as that happened, as soon as I witnessed that horrible, horrible event, that essentially none of our lives were going to be the same. I knew that we'd wind up going to war in order to try to track down bin Laden and his henchmen. And of course we did. But unfortunately, that war wound up expanding virtually globally as a result of multiple authorizations for the use of military force, which have still not been taken off of the books, much to the chagrin of my colleagues here at Cato who work defense and foreign policy. But at the same time, that the military action was initiated, essentially, the planning for it was initiated. Something else started to happen too, and that was a massive domestic surveillance and international surveillance effort designed essentially to identify whether or not any other hijackers were basically potentially on the loose here in the United States. And that began with the National Security Agency and then Director of NSA Michael Hayden, you know, activating a particular program that would subsequently be made public, and we'll talk about that as we get into it. But I knew on that day that, you know, the life of this nation, you know, would simply not be the same. And I'm sure it's never been the same and can never be the same for the victims. But I wanted to just take a couple of minutes for each of you to kind of talk about, you know, where you were and what you were doing and thinking. And Kerry, I'd like to start with you, because you wrote a very, very fascinating and you know, clearly emotional piece for the Just Security blog just a couple of years ago, kind of as remembrance, essentially. And what was it like? You were at the Department of Justice, a relatively new employee at the time. Tell us, if you can, just in a minute or two, you know, what it was like that first day and in the weeks immediately after.
Sure. So, Patrick, it's really great to be with all of you today at the Cato Surveillance Conference. Again, I've been able to be part of this conference in the past year, so I'm glad to be back with all of you and appreciate the historical context that that you're starting off with here as you launch into a series of conversations about present surveillance activities and what the future of surveillance, national security surveillance looks like. That piece, so Just Security is a wonderful blog. I've written for it before. That particular piece, if any members of your viewers want to look at it, was published with Lawfare on the 20th anniversary of September 11th. So that piece was published on September 11th, 2021. And from time to time, I've been able to write reflections on my experience on September 11th. And usually from the context, for many years, I taught a course at Georgetown Law focused on intelligence reform and the changes to the law since 9/11 in the national security space. And usually from time to time over the course of many years after September 11th, 2001, I would focus those pieces on lessons that we could glean from the 9/11 Commission report itself, which was published in 2004, and which provided the authoritative accounting of what transpired in the events leading up to September 11th, and then made recommendations about how to restructure government to prevent any future such activity from ever happening again. And on the 20th anniversary, I thought it was probably finally time to talk a little bit about just what it was like that day. So obviously this was over 20 years ago. So I was a very, very junior employee at the Justice Department. I was a law student at the time, was going to law school at night at American University's Washington College of Law, was working at the Justice Department during the day in what at the time was a tiny, tiny office that reported through a Council for Intelligence Policy to the Attorney General. There was no National Security Division of the Justice Department at that time. There was one small office of probably under 20 lawyers, me as a law clerk, a few administrative staff who were working on counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and other national security matters for the department. And so what I experienced that week really was a small number of people who mobilized to work under the existing legal framework, which was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which we'll spend a lot of time, I think, talking about this hour, and trying to operate in which was what was at the time, obviously, a crisis environment. And so I saw individuals, a lot of the piece that I wrote for Lawfare focuses on, you know, how I looked at individuals who were in leadership positions, how they adapted that week, what it was like for me as a really junior employee at the time, the lowest person on the totem pole, watching senior leaders be in charge, watch them at times seem unsettled. And so it was a very different experience from those who watched the events transpire on TV or read about the events in the news. For me, it was working until 1 o'clock a.m. that night and then coming back to work the next day at 5 a.m. and sort of continuing that pace for days, and many colleagues continued that pace for weeks, if not months. But it was a time where I was present beginning late that morning on September 11th in the FBI Strategic Information Command Center, which then over time ramped up to be the nerve center for the global investigation to uncover what was the plot that became the 9/11 attacks.
My apologies to Ben Wittes and Jack Goldsmith over at Lawfare. It's funny how you can have something written clearly in your notes and then you get something else on your brain. This is what happens when you get old. Yeah, I think that that kind of a wartime environment, your description of it, certainly brings back memories for me for the 1990 Gulf War when I was working at a 24-hour watch center in the intelligence community. So I can identify with that most definitely. Pat Toomey, you were also in law school at the time, if I recall correctly, or getting ready to go to law school. Your perspective, essentially, you know, what were you thinking, you know, essentially? How did you feel ultimately when you saw this unfold? And how did it ultimately inform, you know, some of your career decision making?
Thanks, Pat. And it's great to be here as part of this week talking about how the events of 9/11 still shape many of the conversations and debates we're having today about surveillance. It may surprise you, but I was actually a college student when 9/11 happened, and I just got back from my 20th reunion and was thinking a bit about this coming into the panel. You know, I experienced 9/11 as really a member of the public in a lot of ways, but it was the start of much greater awareness about all the issues that 9/11 raised for us as a country, and you know, all the government powers that were exercised and expanded in the aftermath of those events. And a couple of years after those events, I headed to law school and was part of a clinic team there that worked on a number of the issues that came out of the Bush administration's response to 9/11, including surveillance in the Al-Haramain case, including the Al-Kid versus Ashcroft case related to detention and pretextual detention and arrest of material witnesses, many of whom were Muslim American, and the really vast number of detentions that occurred after 9/11, especially in the New York and New Jersey area of Muslim Americans. So, you know, I think my awareness of the impact of those events as a lawyer grew over time, and the work that I did in those years in law school, I think, had obviously a formative, were formative for me and left a, you know, immense mark on my career path to the ACLU. I got to the ACLU, and I think we'll come back to this, just a couple months before the Snowden disclosures, which were, you know, this event is timed around the 10th anniversary. And the Supreme Court's decision in Clapper versus Amnesty, one of the surveillance cases related to Section 702, came down, I think, 4 or 5 days before I started at the ACLU. And so we were thinking from almost my first day there about how to respond to that decision. And I think as we learned subsequently from Edward Snowden himself, that decision had an immense impact on his choice to release materials to the public that shed huge light on how the government's surveillance activities expanded in the 12 years between 9/11 and those disclosures. So I think we'll come back to many of those topics, but although there were important and dramatic moments of transparency between 9/11 and the Snowden disclosures, those disclosures gave us a much fuller picture into many of the issues related to Section 702 and Executive Order 12333 surveillance that I know we'll get into today.
What were you up to at the time that this incredibly horrible thing happened?
So I was actually on vacation. I was at a house in a remote part of Italy with some friends. I wasn't living in the US at the time. I was living in The Hague. I was working in disarmament and arms control. And we had no TV or anything. But in the afternoon, people's Blackberries, and it was all Blackberries back then, lit up with the news. And I remember going to this hotel in the nearby village that night to watch and see what's happening. And obviously shock and horror that everybody felt. I think I had a little bit of a different perspective on the whole 9/11 experience because for two reasons. One is that I'm Pakistani by birth. So my sort of instant thought was, what does this mean in terms of, you know, where the US is going to go to war. And you know, that was obviously a reasonable fear. But then I didn't come back to the US until 2007, which is when I moved back to the US and started working on national security issues. And the reason I started working on national security issues was because I felt, you know, having left as a, you know, very junior lawyer and coming back as, you know, still fairly sort of mid-level lawyer, I was kind of shocked at what I thought were the changes in the US, both in terms of how I perceived the legal system and how I perceived the society. I had, you know, so many friends who were Pakistanis and Muslims and Arabs who told stories of how they were treated at airports and sometimes even in the streets. And I just really came back to a society that I felt had changed really fundamentally in terms of how it treated Muslims. And that very much motivated me to sort of make my career in this field.
Actually, a perfect segue to the other question that I wanted to ask Carrie about her lawfare piece. In that piece, you said this, and I'm quoting directly, "I did not believe then, and I don't assess now, that 9/11 and Al-Qaeda presented an existential threat to the United States." And it struck me that certainly the Bush administration, from my perspective anyway, definitely treated it as much more along the lines of a seemingly existential threat in terms of, you know, this massive military campaign that was ultimately mounted, not just in Afghanistan, which to my mind was fully justified, but of course against Iraq, which was not, again, in my view. So when you were there at Justice and all of this began to take place, you know, from September all the way essentially through the end of the year, what was the kind of the mindset essentially that you were seeing among your colleagues, and what were you hearing in terms of, you know, what the administration was potentially thinking about doing? Were there any concerns essentially raised, I guess is what I'm asking, about where all of this might take us?
So thanks for the question, Patrick. So I think it's really important that I emphasize for our viewers that this was 20 years ago. And so my perspective at the time was one of someone who was very, very junior, still in law school, not part of the senior level policy conversations that, you know, today in a similar environment I might be part of. So if I think back on this from my perspective at the time, and the conversations that I was part of and the environment that I was part of, it was all about preventing the next attack. So I cannot emphasize to you enough what the threat environment was actually like at that time. And from my perspective at that time, which was to support operational matters and operate within the legal framework and the Justice Department role in supporting operational matters, meaning investigations. The objective was to prevent another similar follow-on attack. And much of the intelligence environment in the days, weeks, months, and years following the September 11, 2001 attacks were of constant, persistent threats that were real efforts by international terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, and then in years later, follow-on groups that adhered to similar ideologies and strove to be as prominent as that era of Al-Qaeda's organization was. Their goal was to conduct more attacks against Americans, against American interest, and other parts of the world as well. So my perspective at the time was, from an operational perspective, our job was to prevent another attack. If I look at things in terms of sort of today's policy environment, or how do I see the changes that have taken place to the laws since September 11th, the Patriot Act, FISA Section 702, FISA Amendments Act, which I know will be perhaps part of our conversation, but also part of much of the conversations as your surveillance week discussions continue. My approach from a policy perspective at this time is moving forward. So in other words, much of the work that I've engaged in has been not to try to undo changes to the law that, from my perspective, did prevent another follow-on attack on the scale of 9/11, but also to make sure that those laws and the changes to the laws are modernized, are adapted to reflect the current threat environment, which is one that is really, really different than what it was like 20 years ago.
What's really interesting, and thank you for those observations, and I understand the limitations that you faced at the time in terms of potentially, you know, access, obviously, to the higher level decision-making discussions that were taking place. But I just find it really interesting, all of the discussion essentially that we're having around 702 and I would say around the Patriot Act ultimately as well, which we'll get into in more detail just in a moment. These were authorities that did not exist prior to 9/11. And what both the Congressional Joint Inquiry found in 2002 and the 9/11 Commission 2 years later was that it was not a lack of collection that got us in trouble. It was a failure to actually connect the dots, to use the words of the chairman, Governor Kaine, you know, of the 9/11 Commission. And so that's what I find so interesting about so much of the discussion about these authorities that were subsequently enacted, is that they were put in place essentially before any investigation had actually taken place into why the attacks had succeeded. And so we have this bizarre situation, in my view at least, of putting literally the cart before the horse from a policy standpoint. And, you know, Faiza had mentioned in her intro remarks that the concerns about what would ultimately happen to Arab and Muslim Americans and, you know, just Arab and Muslim immigrants here, you know, that really became a major focus ultimately. And Faiza, go ahead and share with us, in essence, kind of remind the audience, if you will, what happened in those weeks and months after the attacks from an immigration standpoint and a domestic search and seizure standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think two of the big things that happened were really using immigration laws, right? So using the material witness laws, for example, to, as Patrick mentioned, to round up Arab Muslim men, mainly New York and New Jersey, and put them into detention. And I think about 1,200 people were rounded up. You know, I don't think anything really ever came of it, but there were surely deportations and immigration violations and the like. But that was a very frightening thing for the Muslim community. I think people still talk about that, right? Because that was such a shock to the system that, like, people were getting picked up en masse on the streets. And around the same time, you had the voluntary questioning program, where you had law enforcement agents often working with local police, again, rounding up Arab Muslim men, immigrants, so not American citizens. About 8,000 people were called in for these interviews, which were supposedly voluntary. They weren't voluntary. I mean, there was a huge amount of pressure, obviously, to come in and to talk to the authorities. Again, sending a sort of a seismic shock through communities that were really, you know, pretty low-key part of American society, right? It was not a community that was used to seeing itself as discriminated against. Obviously, there was discrimination, but it wasn't a community that sort of saw itself as vulnerable particularly. And then you had NCOs. I mean, you started getting the institutionalization, right? You start off with these sort of very broad measures and very sort of physical and in your face. And then you start having this institutionalization. You have the NCERS program, for example, which was the registration, again, focused on immigrant communities. And then you have just a series of different programs, right? Starting with things like how the FBI was investigating individuals, right? You move away from the idea that investigations should be tethered to some form of criminal suspicion, and you go to this idea that, well, as long as you are, you know, you have an authorized purpose in the view of an agent, you can start an investigation, or at least an assessment. And these, I think, have led to some of the biggest abuses of the last 20 years, where Muslim communities have had informants placed in them, just basically listening in, not going to a mosque or a community center because they suspect someone there is terrorist or has links to a terrorist or has committed a crime or might be committing a crime, but just to sit in there and listen. And I think that that is the big change, I think, that over the last two decades, which I think has sort of basically infused our entire system, just this change from looking for something that is predicated to just kind of looking broadly for people who are might be doing something wrong in some vision. And so I think that's been a huge change for the Muslim American community also in terms of its own self-perception, right? Going from a community that was relatively well integrated, you know, big parts of the community are relatively well educated, they're well off, they don't see themselves as being vulnerable or victims. And now over the last 20 years, I think that has really changed, where Muslim Americans' view has really changed.
I'd like to, you know, bring Pat Toomey into the conversation, and in fact, all of you. Faiza has kind of brought us up to almost the mid-decade period of the 2000s now with references to the use of assessments, and for the benefit of our audience, in December of 2008, then Attorney General Michael Mukasey, essentially as one of his last acts going out of office, updated what are known as the Attorney General Guidelines for domestic FBI investigations. And those guidelines were originally promulgated in 1976 by then Attorney General Edward Levy, and this was all happening in the wake of the major scandals involving the FBI with the so-called counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO, and a lot of the concerns that flowed out of that. There were efforts to try to actually get a legislative charter for the FBI through the Congress. There was a lot of discussion, and it wasn't just the FBI. There were multiple components of law and federal law enforcement and the intelligence community that then Senator Inouye was thinking about trying to basically, you know, put under some kind of legislative charter. But Ed Levy, when he issued those initial guidelines, essentially succeeded in taking the wind out of the sails. And the guidelines underwent, you know, various changes over the course of the years. But Mukasey's changes in December 2008 were by far the most remarkable, as far as I'm concerned. And the most important one is the one that Faiza has already mentioned, which is this creation of a de facto category of investigation called an assessment. And these assessments do not require any kind of criminal predicate to open. When I first learned of the existence of these things, I was rather shocked that it would be possible to have something like this in the United States. And of course, I think a lot of the rationale behind that was, at least in part, this massive information flow that Carrie has referenced. When you get just oodles and oodles of information coming in, it's obviously going to put tremendous pressure on investigators to try to figure out, you know, essentially what's real and what's not, separating the chaff from the wheat, if you will. But by the same token, our criminal justice system is essentially predicated on this idea of individual guilt, and normally tethered to some kind of reasonable suspicion, if not probable cause. So I'm just wondering, you know, Carrie, I don't know how much time you spent, you know, looking at the FBI's use of assessments and these overall investigative authorities. But if you've got some thoughts essentially on this, I would certainly really love to hear them.
Sure. So just to start off feedback in terms of that part of the conversation. So so the guidelines actually, you started with Levy and you ended with Mukasey, but there was substantial revisions by Attorney General Ashcroft in the intervening years. And one of the significant things about the review that Attorney General Ashcroft did is there used to be a whole bunch of different, to summarize it, there used to be a whole bunch of different sets of Attorney General guidelines for different types of investigations, national security, criminal, depending on sort of the different category of investigation. And Attorney General Ashcroft, working with the FBI and his Office of Legal Policy, and it was a very comprehensive multi-year effort throughout the Justice Department and working with the FBI to revise the guidelines and condense them down to them what became the Attorney General guidelines for FBI domestic operations. And so the from my perspective, the really substantial revisions and modernization to the guidelines came during that set of years. With respect to assessments in particular, so there's different categories for our viewers, there's different categories of investigations. There's what's a full and what's called a full investigation, when that enables the investigators to use very intrusive techniques like surveillance or searches. And there's what was called preliminary investigations. And then this category of threat assessments basically was intended, as I understood it at the time, to enable investigators to do certain limited types of investigative steps and checks, checking public source, open source information, for example, or checking into certain databases of information that had already been collected, but a limited scope of review if, for example, some type of report were to come into investigators and they just need to be able to do the very early stages of looking into something to determine whether or not it needs further investigation. So it really was intended, my understanding at the time, was to free up investigators to do a limited set of checks or queries or early stage look into something to determine whether it then needed further follow-on and investigation. From an oversight perspective, and as a lawyer at the Justice Department many years ago, I was involved in a lot of the oversight efforts. From an oversight perspective, what an overseer, whether within the department or from Congress's perspective, would want to make sure is that those assessments follow the timeframes that they were intended to be in. So they were supposed to only be for a certain amount of time, not continue on indefinitely or for a long period of time, that they were conducted in the cabined or limited scope that they were intended. And you just want to make sure that there's sufficient oversight over that process so that they are conducted in the narrow way that they were originally intended. And that if it turns out that investigators conduct a threat assessment and there's nothing there, then that matter needs to be closed.
Pat, Liza, how's it actually worked out with assessments?
I'll start and say a bit. We have been very critical of that addition to the Attorney General guidelines. It does not require factual predication, I think, as Faiza mentioned, and it encompasses some very intrusive techniques, even though it is supposed to be very, very, more preliminary than a preliminary investigation. I think the lack of factual predication has really opened the door to discrimination and bias profiling and confirmation bias to operate at certain very early stages of FBI investigations. And so I think assessments have been hugely problematic for many of the Muslim immigrant and Muslim American communities that we've talked about, but we also believe that it's proven problematic for Asian American and Chinese Americans who are now coming under scrutiny by the FBI in the context of the China Initiative, which now has been formally disavowed, but the rising geopolitical tensions with China. So, and I'll just mention, because I know we'll come back to Section 702, that our understanding for a while has been that agents can even run queries through the Section 702 databases. Now, I think there are some additional rules that constrain them, but the availability of even those intrusive tools to search warrantlessly through Americans' private emails and other communications, raises serious concerns about what agents can look at and how they can intrude on people's privacy, even at that very threshold stage.
And for a sec? Yeah, I think one thing to just kind of clarify is that searching public databases doesn't actually require an assessment. I mean, according to the FBI, they have the authority to do that regardless of whether or not an assessment is open. And as Patrick mentioned, actually, the tools available in the assessment, while you're right, Carrie, obviously not a search warrant level tool, but there's a lot of information that is available in government databases, probably a lot more now than there was back in 2008. So that is actually access to a really, really broad variety of information. You can also, at an assessment stage, you know, task certain informants who are already on board, for example. And the way I look at it, assessments really sort of turn the issue on its head. They really kind of enable the FBI to go out and look for people who might have committed some kind of crime, right? So they're not actually looking based on anything objective. And that's what gives them the opportunity, that sort of opens the door to bias. And I think in the post 9/11 world, that bias was really firmly directed at Muslim Americans. And that's really where we saw the brunt of these assessments playing out. I think it also really ties into a lot of the kind of sting operations that have been very controversial over the last 20 years, where you have, you know, somebody who goes into a mosque, like that guy in California, Craig Montiel, right? Goes into a mosque, says he is tasked to basically, you know, go around saying provocative and controversial things and perhaps pull people into some kind of plot that is manufactured by the FBI. Now, I understand that there are a lot of people in every community, including the Muslim American community, who say some crazy shit, right? They say stuff that's like really disturbing. But that stuff gets taken seriously when Muslims say it. And it obviously doesn't get taken seriously when other people say it, as we've seen pretty clearly illustrated over the last couple of years.
You've raised a very interesting question there, Faiza, with respect to speech and how it can potentially trigger surveillance. Carrie, when you were a justice, how much did the Brandenburg v. Ohio decision come up in the context of, you know, some of these kinds of investigations where there was a clear, you know, domestic nexus? I'm just curious. And for the benefit of our viewers and our listeners, in 1969, Clarence Brandenburg, a member of the Ku Klux Klan in Ohio, basically was shut down from, you know, engaging in his kind of speech under a particular syndicalism statute that had been on the books. Long story short, he appeals. It ultimately gets to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court creates a two-part test with respect to, you know, this line between just really vile speech and an actual transition towards an imminent incitement to violence. And that's, I think, essentially, you know, what Faiza was kind of indirectly referencing here. So, Carrie, I'm just curious, you know, to the extent that you can recall, and I know it's been a long time, or even since you've been at Justice, if you've had a chance to think about that particular issue, but at least at Justice when you were there, this issue of Brandenburg v. Ohio, this line between speech and action, how often did that come up? I'm just kind of curious.
So I have two thoughts on this. One, which goes back to my days as an operational counterterrorism lawyer working on cases that went before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and then one that I think is really relevant to today's domestic security threat environment. So on the prior, I would say that First Amendment issues were constantly top of mind to particularly the lawyers at the Justice Department who were working with agents and analysts to prepare matters that went to the court. A FISA court application includes a factual recitation of an investigation, and the Attorney General guidelines for FBI domestic operations contain a caveat that the investigation and so then therefore that continued into FISA surveillance cannot be based solely on First Amendment activities. So that concept of investigative activities, surveillance requests, search requests, as a general matter, not being based solely on First Amendment activities was a concept and a legal concept that was, I think, constantly top of mind to individuals, national security professionals who were working on these types of investigations. That being said, the solely is important. The word solely is important because what people say online, what they might be communicating that's obtained through other intelligence sources can be a factor, just can't be the dispositive factor. So if you're an investigator or a lawyer reviewing a case, you can't ignore threatening statements or writings or engagement that an individual may have that is of a threatening nature. But if it is First Amendment protected activity, it cannot be the only basis to go forward on. So I think that principle, Patrick, held certainly throughout the time that I was involved in national security operational matters back then. I think it's even a harder issue that federal investigators are working through now as it pertains to domestic terrorism cases or racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism, which is currently presently a serious and significant threat in the US. And there is also a transnational aspect to these types of violent extremist groups. And in fact, if I can just mention, tomorrow on this at Center for New American Security, I'm gonna have Nick Rasmussen, who's the DHS counterterrorism coordinator, as well as some other experts in the area, talk about that aspect of things. I do tend to assess as an outsider now that the government is perhaps struggling some with adapting its investigative activities in a way that robustly and as they did 20 years ago, seriously look at the international terrorism threat of the Al-Qaeda variety and take equally seriously racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism and related domestic violent extremism in the US and be able to appropriately navigate that First Amendment line. Because the reason it becomes harder is because you're just dealing with many more Americans who are engaged in this activity. And so the First Amendment issues become more prevalent because the investigative subjects are primarily here in the US as opposed to foreign-based subjects. So I'll pause there. I would imagine Patrick and Faiza probably have thoughts about that as well. Faiza, I think you're muted.
Yeah.
No?
There we go. We can hear you now.
Okay. Thank you. I think one of the things that you raise, Carrie, is kind of interesting, right? As you know, people who sort of started out working on the international terrorism and now are like trying to adapt to domestic terrorism, it's just really interesting to see the struggle in a sense. For a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, in terms of numbers, if you take January 6th out of the equation, I'm not sure that the number of Americans being looked at by the FBI today is that different when they were really focused on Muslim Americans over the last two decades. It's a little bit difficult to know because their categories are so fuzzy, so it's a little bit difficult to know exactly who's being looked at in what context. But I think one thing that's always struck me is the fact that with Muslim Americans, there is always a presumption that they have some kind of at least ideological affinity for a foreign terrorist ideology. Whereas the sort of transnational aspects of white supremacist violence are sort of secondary. And the thing that really strikes me in this is the fact that the categories and the descriptions are so different within law enforcement. So homegrown violent extremists, HGVE, is the term that is used by the FBI, by DHS, and other agencies when they're talking about Muslim Americans who they suspect of terrorism, right? And all that really means is that even if someone is born in this country, raised in this country, is an American, right? The fact that they have some ideological affinity with a supposed foreign ideology is enough to put them in a special category. Whereas domestic violent extremism or domestic terrorism is treated as something different, right? It's something where these are real Americans, it seems. These are people for whom the ideology is considered to be an American ideology. Now, without sort of going into the idea of like which is which, I mean, I think both those notions to me seem really wrong, because ideology just transcends national borders, but they do reflect this sort of fundamental underlying concept of Muslim Americans as other and a sort of white supremacists as being more American. Sorry, maybe that was a little too much punditry there, but like I really feel that that is just so fundamental to how the differences in how these two issues are approached.
I do want to get Pat Toomey an opportunity to jump in here, but just very quickly for some historical context, and I do think it is really important. I've finished a manuscript dealing with domestic surveillance and political repression, the first of a two-volume series. And this particular manuscript covers the period essentially from 1901 all the way up through Dwight Eisenhower's last day in office. And what's fascinating, or what was fascinating and terrifying, was to go through records from the World War I era and to see just exactly how victimized German Americans were. And I'm talking about lynchings, I'm talking about murders, all these kinds of things. So I think it's a phenomenon that unfortunately is human, because here you were talking about, you know, one group of essentially Anglo-Americans, you know, persecuting another group of white Americans, a large number of them ultimately. And again, it's that foreigner aspect to it, right? I mean, so there has to be, you know, they have to be colluding in some way, right? And I think it's a broader, ultimately societal problem. It's just that over the course of the last, and I would actually go back further, Faiza, I think the focus on Arab and Muslim Americans easily goes back to the Palestinian rights era. I mean, they targeted Professor Said at Columbia and so many others. And there's the whole Volga betrayal investigation, which we don't remotely have time to get into today. So I don't think there's any question that's been going on. But this is a phenomenon that if you go back and you actually look at the historical record, an awful lot of groups, either ethnically, religiously, politically, have wound up in the government's crosshairs. And it's a completely consistent pattern. And that's what, to me, speaks to kind of the larger problem that I think we're dealing with here. I'd like to come back to that, but I want to give Pat Toomey an opportunity to respond there.
I mean, the only thing I'll add quickly on the First Amendment question is to come back to Carrie's point about the most of the regulations, both in some of the statutes and the rules, use this term solely, and it is it's heartening to know that is taken really seriously by people working in the government. But I think what we've seen from outside the government is that term bears a lot of weight and almost becomes vanishingly small category. There's a FISA court opinion that we obtained through some of our litigation in the court for public access that deals with one of these issues. And although it's redacted, it kind of illustrates how, you know, even showing support for an organization, making statements of support for an organization that engages in acts of terrorism can be stretched in a way that where the FISA court in that instance granted approval to conduct surveillance under Section 215, which has the solely limitation. So it's very, and outside the government, it appears very easy to kind of find something else that you know, the government says makes it, you know, shows that it's not solely for First Amendment purposes.
Job, I think, kind of setting up this whole issue of the future. And I'm sure that all of us, the four of us that are on this panel probably feel pretty much the same way about what happened leading up to, during, and after January 6th. But it does raise questions when we start talking about drawing a line again between speech and action. And, you know, we have Anne Vroom online asking essentially, she uses the phrase cooperative task forces. I think what she's probably referencing are actually the joint terrorism task forces. You know, when we start talking about these federal, state, and local partnerships, how much of a concern, Carrie, do you have about the state and local law enforcement partners necessarily being as well-versed and as concerned about these kinds of issues that FISA and Pat have raised with respect, you know, to First Amendment protections as they pertain to investigations?
Well, it's important to keep in mind, you know, what are the roles and responsibilities of the different security services or law enforcement organizations. So it's the FBI at the federal government that is primarily tasked with conducting national security investigations, counterterrorism investigations, including domestic terrorism investigations. That is their job, and the FBI has primary responsibility for those types of investigations. Then at the federal government level, there's the Department of Homeland Security, and in particular, the Office of Intelligence and Analysis, which has a role in information sharing, both from state and local and other law enforcement up to the intelligence community, as well as the other way, pushing information that the federal government knows out to state and local law enforcement. State and local law enforcement, on the other hand, their primary job is public safety. And protecting their communities, and that the nature of the law enforcement and public safety challenges that they face often depends on a particular region, and different areas have particular challenges that they are dealing with, whether it's a particular region that is struggling with addressing the fentanyl crisis, for example, or other types of drug trafficking, gun violence, other, you know, every region has different types of issues that they're dealing with all across the country. But I would suggest to you that it is the federal government that is primarily responsible for uncovering threats and plots to conduct terrorism-related activities, whether that is international terrorism activities or whether that is domestic terrorism activities.
To be a little bit more precise, I think the concern that I have, and it's a concern I know that's shared, I'm sure, by our other panelists, is the number of state and local law enforcement officers who wind up being deputized by the FBI, by DEA, by other HSI over at the Department of Homeland Security. And I think, you know, one of the concerns that I have is, first off, we don't know how many people that involves, you know, how many state and locals get that kind of protection, because once they are actually deputized to act in a federal capacity, that means qualified immunity, you know, comes into play for these officers, certainly in the federal context. And so if they engage in misconduct, it's in that respect, it's virtually impossible to hold them accountable. So I certainly have, you know, grave concerns on that. We have about 6 minutes left here in this panel. I wanted to make sure that we managed to get in at least another question or two from our audience. Some folks are asking, you know, why hasn't more been done to look into the rioters who burned federal offices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There was an awful lot of that, of course, that did happen. Portland was a nexus for that. And it's my understanding, and I'm sure that Carrie and perhaps the others will correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that there have, in fact, been a number of prosecutions of those individuals that have taken place. Am I off base on that? I'm pretty sure that we have seen prosecutions for the destruction, particularly the attacks on some of the federal buildings in Portland and elsewhere. Okay, I'm pretty sure
certainly
we have.
If there's damage to federal property, federal government is pretty aggressive about being able to prosecute those types of cases. And the January 6th investigation is also an example of a substantial nationwide, extremely large and extensive investigation prosecuting individuals who were involved in the assault on the Capitol.
Well, what I don't want us to leave today without giving each of you an opportunity to opine on the one federal surveillance authority that is actually up for either renewal or expiration. Pat, I'll start with you and we'll go to FISA, and Carrie, you will get the last word.
Sure. You're referring to Section 702 of FISA, which is up for renewal or expiration due to sunset in December of this year. And even now, about 7 months out, we've seen a growing public debate around whether it should be reformed, reauthorized, allowed to sunset. Just a couple weeks ago, there was the release of some new opinions by the FISA court, the Secret Intelligence Court, describing the use of Section 702 to look for communications, including in the context of what seemed to be protests after George Floyd's death, and in the context of the January 6th investigation, which I think grabbed a lot of headlines, because the use of these types of searches, warrantless queries of people's communications that were obtained through Section 702 surveillance of people overseas, is increasingly controversial, and I think the public is still learning how broadly those queries are used and the different purposes that they serve. And so we at the ACLU, we've been litigating challenges to Section 702 for years. The courts have been, the courts continue to evaluate many of the important constitutional questions around whether, when you query someone who's been an American who's been subjected to this surveillance, what constitutional rules apply. And those questions are front and center for Congress as well. And our view is that fundamental reforms are needed to bring Section 702 in line with the Constitution.
FISA?
I have to associate myself with everything Patrick just said. We think fundamental reforms are in fact needed for 702, and these repeated releases from the FISA court, which show that over and over again, the FBI has been accessing warrantlessly collected data about Americans, not for any, national security purpose, but really for all kinds of things, and at really alarming rates. I remember, I don't think it was this release, Patrick, but the one before, where they were using 702 to check for, do security clearances for contractors or something like that. And the numbers have been very large. I understand they have diminished most recently as they have separated 702 data out into a separate database, which seems to me like a good development. But this really can't go on. And the FISA court has proved itself like totally unwilling to really constrain the FBI in this way.
Can you tell us why the authority should be reauthorized?
Congress absolutely should renew Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It is absolutely a critical intelligence tool, although it was passed in an era where the primary justification at the time was for counterterrorism purposes. It has it was originally intended, and it has evolved into being an intelligence collection framework under the law that enables collection about a wide array of national security threats. And so, today's threat environment, what that means is that it enables intelligence collection about what China is up to, about what Russia is up to vis-a-vis the Ukraine war, North Korea, Iran, other threats. So it has a much broader use that is absolutely critical to national security, because what it enables the government to do is be able to use information when these foreign adversaries are using the U.S. communications networks and systems. And so it's absolutely a critical authority. In the past, when this authority has been scheduled to sunset, there has been bipartisan support. And so I hope by the end of the year that that bipartisan consensus can be reached again to renew this important authority.
And Carrie has basically brought us to the end of our program today. My thanks to Carrie Cordero, FISA Patel, and Patrick Toomey for a great discussion today. I hope that it was enlightening for our audience, talking about some of the history, but also especially some of the current events. And with respect to Cato Surveillance Week. It continues tomorrow at 1 o'clock Eastern here, same place, where we will engage in a much broader discussion, as well as a fairly deep discussion on surveillance reform prospects. Of course, FISA Section 702 will be a centerpiece of that discussion, but we'll be talking about other things like Executive Order 12333, a particular Drug Enforcement Administration authority that I am very deeply concerned about, and probably a whole lot more that we're going to try to cram into that hour. So I really hope that you will join us. For the Cato Institute, I'm Patrick Eddington. Thanks for watching.